was incensed.
To hell with this. We didn't walk 10 miles for 1.5 scrawny apples, did we, Liesl?
Liesl did not answer. She did not have time, for Victor Chemmel was on top of Rudy before she could utter a word. His knees had pinned Rudy's arms, and his hands were around his throat. The apples were scooped up by none other than Andy Schmeichel, at Victor's request.
"You're hurting him," Liesl said.
"Am I?" Victor was smiling again. She hated that smile.
"He's not hurting me."
Rudy's words were rushed together, and his face was red with strain. His nose began to bleed. After an extended moment or two of increased pressure, Victor let Rudy go and climbed off him, taking a few careless steps. He said, "Get up, boy." And Rudy, choosing wisely, did as he was told. Victor came casually closer again and faced him. He gave him a gentle rub on the arm, a whisper. "Unless you want me to turn that blood into a fountain, I suggest you go away, little boy." He looked at Liesl. "And take the little slut with you." No one moved.
"Well, what are you waiting for?"
Liesl took Rudy's hand, and they left. But not before Rudy turned one last time and spat some blood and saliva at Victor Chemmel's feet. It evoked one final remark. A small threat from Victor Chemmel to Rudy Steiner. "You'll pay for that at a later date, my friend." Say what you will about Victor Chemmel, but he certainly had patience and a good memory. It took him approximately 5 months to turn his statement into a true one. Sketches. If the summer of 1941 was walling up around the likes of Rudy and Liesl, it was writing and painting itself into the life of Max Vandenberg. In his loneliest moments in the basement, the words started piling up around him. The visions began to pour and fall, and occasionally limp from out of his hands. He had what he called just a small ration of tools. A painted book, a handful of pencils, a mindful of thoughts. Like a simple puzzle, he put them together. Originally, Max had intended to write his own story. The idea was to write about everything that had happened to him, all that had led him to a Himmel Street basement. But it was not what came out. Max's exile produced something else entirely. It was a collection of random thoughts, and he chose to embrace them. They felt true. They were more real than the letters he wrote to his family and to his friend Walter Kugler, knowing very well that he could never send them. The desecrated pages of Mein Kampf were becoming a series of sketches, page after page, which to him summed up the events that had swapped his former life for another. There were Führers on podiums, conducting hordes of people with words like music notes. There was a swastika sun shining on Nazis as they hiked over mountains made of Jews. Some of the sketches took minutes, others hours. He resolved that when the book was finished, he'd give it to Liesl when she was old enough, and hopefully when all this nonsense was over. From the moment he tested the pencils on the first painted page, he kept the book close at all times. Often it was next to him or still in his fingers as he slept. One afternoon, after his push-ups and sit-ups, he fell asleep against the basement wall. When Liesl came down, she found the book sitting next to him, slanted against his thigh, and curiosity got the better of her. She leaned over and picked it up, waiting for him to stir. He didn't. Max was sitting with his head and shoulder blades against the wall. She could barely make out the sound of his breath, coasting in and out of him, as she opened the book and glimpsed a few random pages. Frightened by what she saw, Liesl placed the book back down, exactly as she found it, against Max's leg. A voice startled her. "Danke schön," it said, and when she looked across, following the trail of sound to its owner, a small sign of satisfaction was present on his Jewish lips.
"Holy Christ!"
Liesl gasped.
You scared me, Max.
He returned to his sleep, and behind her, the girl dragged the same thought up the steps. You scared me, Max. The Whistler and the Shoes. The same pattern continued through the end of summer and well into autumn. Rudy did his best to survive the Hitler Youth. Max did his push-ups and made his sketches. Liesl found newspapers and wrote her words on the basement wall. It's also worthy of mention that every pattern has at least one small bias, and one day it will tip itself over or fall from one page to another. In this case, the dominant factor was Rudy. Or at least, Rudy and a freshly fertilized sports field. Late in October, all appeared to be usual. A filthy boy was walking down Himmel Street. Within a few minutes, his family would expect his arrival, and he would lie that everyone in his Hitler Youth division was given extra drills in the field. His parents would even expect some laughter. They didn't get it. Today, Rudy was all out of laughter and lies. On this particular Wednesday, when Liesl looked more closely, she could see that Rudy Steiner was shirtless. And he was furious. What happened? She asked as he trudged past. He reversed back and held out the shirt. Smell it, he said. What? Are you deaf? I said smell it. Reluctantly, Liesl leaned in and caught a ghastly whiff of the brown garment. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, is that... The boy nodded. It's on my chin, too. My chin. I'm lucky I didn't swallow it. Jesus, Mary and Joseph. The field at Hitler Youth just got fertilized. He gave his shirt another half-hearted, disgusted appraisal. It's cow manure, I think. Did... What's his name? Deutscher know it was there? He says he didn't, but he was grinning. Jesus, Mary, could you stop saying that? What Rudy needed at this point in time was a victory. He had lost in his dealings with Victor Chemmel. He'd endured problem after problem at the Hitler Youth. All he wanted was a small scrap of triumph, and he was determined to get it. He continued home, but when he reached the concrete step, he changed his mind and came slowly, purposefully back to the girl. Careful and quiet, he spoke. You know what would cheer me up? Liesl cringed. If you think I'm going to... in that state... He seemed disappointed in her. No, not that. He sighed and stepped closer. Something else. After a moment's thought, he raised his head just a touch. Look at me. I'm filthy. I stink like... cow shit or dog shit, whatever your opinion, and as usual, I'm absolutely starving. He paused. I need a win, Liesl. Honestly. Liesl knew. She'd have gone closer, but for the smell of him. Stealing. They had to steal something. No, they had to steal something back. It didn't matter what. It needed only to be soon. Just you and me this time. Rudy suggested. No Chemmels, no Schmeichels. Just you and me. The girl couldn't help it. Her hands itched, her pulse split, and her mouth smiled all at the same time. Sounds good. It's agreed, then. And although he tried not to, Rudy could not hide the fertilized grin that grew on his face. Tomorrow? Liesl nodded. Tomorrow. Their plan was perfect, but for one thing. They had no idea where to start. Fruit was out. Rudy snubbed his nose at onions and potatoes, and they drew the line at another attempt on Otto Sturm and his bike full of farm produce. Once was immoral, twice was complete bastardry.
So where the hell do we go? Rudy asked. How should I know? This was your idea, wasn't it? That doesn't mean you shouldn't think a little, too. I can't think of everything. You can barely think of anything.
They argued on as they walked through town. On the outskirts, They witnessed the first of the farms and the trees standing like emaciated statues. The branches were grey, and when they looked up at them, there was nothing but ragged limbs and empty sky. Rudy spat. They walked back through Malking, making suggestions.
What about Frau Diller?
What about her?
Maybe if we say Heil Hitler and then steal something, we'll be all right.
After roaming Munich Street for an hour or so, the daylight was drawing to a close, and they were on the verge of giving up.
It's pointless, Rudy said,
and I'm even hungrier now than I've ever been. I'm starving, for Christ's sake.
He walked another dozen steps before he stopped and looked back.
What's with you?
Because now Liesel was standing completely still, and a moment of realization was strapped to her face.
Why hadn't she thought of it before?
What is it?
Rudy was becoming impatient.
Sau Mensch, what's going on?
At that very moment, Liesel was presented with a decision. Could she truly carry out what she was thinking? Could she really seek revenge on a person like this? Could she despise someone this much? She began walking in the opposite direction. When Rudy caught up, she slowed a little in the vain hope of achieving a little more clarity. After all, the guilt was already there. It was moist. The seed was already bursting into a dark-leafed flower. She weighed up whether she could really go through with this. At a crossroad, she stopped.
I know a place.
They went over the river and made their way up the hill. On Grandestrasse, they took in the splendour of the houses. The front doors glowed with polish, and the roof tiles sat like toupees, combed to perfection. The walls and windows were manicured, and the chimneys almost breathed out smoke rings. Rudy planted his feet.
The mayor's house?
Liesel nodded seriously. A pause.
They fired my mama.
When they angled toward it, Rudy asked just how in God's name they were going to get inside. But Liesel knew.
Local knowledge, she answered.
Local.
But when they were able to see the window to the library at the far end of the house, she was greeted with a shock.
The window was closed.
Well?
Rudy asked. Liesel swiveled slowly and hurried off.
Not today, she said.
Rudy laughed.
I knew it,
he caught up.
I knew it, you filthy Sau Mensch. You couldn't get in there even if you had the key.
Do you mind?
She quickened even more and brushed aside Rudy's commentary.
We just have to wait for the right opportunity.
Internally, she shrugged away from a kind of gladness that the window was closed. She berated herself.
Why, Liesel, she asked. Why did you have to explode when they fired Mama? Why couldn't you just keep your big mouth shut?
For all you know, the mayor's wife is now completely reformed after you yelled and screamed at her. Maybe she straightened herself out, picked herself up. Maybe she'll never let herself shiver in that house again, and the window will be shut forever, you stupid Sau Mensch. A week later, however, on their fifth visit to the upper part of Malking, it was there. The open window breathed a slice of air in. That was all it would take. It was Rudy who stopped first. He tapped Liesel in the ribs with the back of his hand.
Is that window, he whispered, open?
The eagerness in his voice leaned from his mouth like a forearm onto Liesel's shoulder.
Jawohl,
she answered.
It sure is.
And how her heart began to heat. On each previous occasion, when they found the window clamped firmly shut, Liesel's outer disappointment had masked a ferocious relief. Would she have had the neck to go in? And who and what, in fact, was she going in for? For Rudy? To locate some food? No, the repugnant truth was this. She didn't care about the food. Rudy, no matter how hard she tried to resist the idea, was secondary to her plan. It was the book she wanted. The Whistler. She wouldn't tolerate having it given to her by a lonely, pathetic old woman. Stealing it, on the other hand, seemed a little more acceptable.
Stealing it, in a sick kind of sense, was like earning it. The light was changing in blocks of shade. The pair of them gravitated toward the immaculate, bulky house. They rustled their thoughts.
You hungry?
Rudy asked. Liesl replied.
Starving.
For a book.
Look, a light just came on upstairs. I see it. Still hungry, Zalmensch?
They laughed nervously for a moment before going through the motions of who should go in and who should stand watch. As the male in the operation, Rudy clearly felt that he should be the aggressor, but it was obvious that Liesl knew this place. It was she who was going in. She knew what was on the other side of the window. She said it.
It has to be me.
Liesl closed her eyes.
Tightly.
She compelled herself to remember, to see visions of the mayor and his wife. She watched her gathered friendship with Ilse Hermann and made sure to see it kicked in the shins and left by the wayside. It worked. She detested them. They scouted the street and crossed the yard silently. Now they were crouched beneath the slit in the window on the ground floor. The sound of their breathing amplified.
Here, Rudy said. Give me your shoes. You'll be quiet.
Without complaint, Liesl undid the worn black laces and left the shoes on the ground. She rose up, and Rudy gently opened the window just wide enough for Liesl to climb through. The noise of it passed overhead, like a low-flying plane. Liesl heaved herself onto the ledge and tussled away inside. Taking off her shoes, she realized, was a brilliant idea, as she landed much heavier on the wooden floor than she'd anticipated. The soles of her feet expanded in that painful way, rising to the inside edges of her socks. The room itself was as it always was. Liesl, in the dusty dimness, shrugged off her feelings of nostalgia. She crept forward and allowed her eyes to adjust.
What's going on?
Rudy whispered sharply from outside, but she waved him a backhander that meant Halt's Maul.
Keep quiet. The food, he reminded her. Find the food! And cigarettes, if you can.
Both items, however, were the last things on her mind. She was home, among the mayor's books of every color and description, with their silver and gold lettering.
She could smell the pages.
She could almost taste the words as they stacked up around her. Her feet took her to the right-hand wall. She knew the one she wanted, the exact position. But when she made it to the whistler's usual place on the shelf, it was not there. A slight gap was in its place. From above, she heard footsteps.
The light, Rudy whispered.
The words were shoved through the open window.
It's out. Scheiße. They're coming downstairs.
There was a giant length of a moment then, the eternity of split-second decision. Her eyes scanned the room, and she could see the whistler sitting patiently on the mayor's desk.
Hurry up, Rudy warned her.
But very calmly and cleanly, Liesl walked over, picked up the book, and made her way cautiously out.
Head first.
She climbed from the window, managing to land on her feet again, feeling the pang of pain once more, this time in her ankles.
Come on,
Rudy implored her.
Run, run, schnell!
Once around the corner, on the road back down to the river and Munich Street, she stopped to bend over and recover. Her body was folded in the middle, the air half frozen in her mouth, her heart tolling in her ears. Rudy was the same. When he looked over, he saw the book under her arm. He struggled to speak.
What's...
he grappled with the words.
With the book!
The darkness was filling up truly now. Liesl panted, the air in her throat defrosting.
It was all I could find.
Unfortunately, Rudy could smell it. The lie. He cocked his head and told her what he felt was a fact.
You didn't go in for food, did you? You got what you wanted.
Liesl straightened then and was overcome with the sickness of another realization.
The shoes.
She looked at Rudy's feet, then at his hands, and at the ground all around him. What? He asked. What is it?
Zaukel,
she accused him. Where are my shoes? Rudy's face whitened, which left her in no doubt.
They're back at the house,
she suggested. Aren't they? Rudy searched desperately around himself, begging against all reality that he might have brought them with him. He imagined himself picking them up, wishing it true. But the shoes were not there. They sat uselessly, or actually much worse, incriminatingly, by the wall at 8 Grunderstrasse.
Dummkopf!
He admonished himself, smacking his ear. He looked down shamefully at the sullen sight of Liesel's socks.
Idiot!
It didn't take him long to decide on making it right. Earnestly, he said,
Just wait.
And he hurried back around the corner.
Don't get caught!
Liesel called after him, but he didn't hear. The minutes were heavy while he was gone. Darkness was now complete, and Liesel was quite certain that a Wutschen was most likely in the cards when she returned home.
Hurry,
she murmured, but still Rudy didn't appear. She imagined the sound of a police siren throwing itself forward and reeling itself in, collecting itself. Still, nothing. Only when she walked back to the intersection of the two streets in her damp, dirty socks did she see him. Rudy's triumphant face was held nicely up as he trotted steadily toward her. His teeth were gnashed into a grin, and the shoes dangled from his hand.
They nearly killed me, he said, but I made it.
Once they'd crossed the river, he handed Liesel the shoes, and she threw them down. Sitting on the ground, she looked up at her best friend.
Danke,
she said.
Thank you.
Rudy bowed.
My pleasure.
He tried for a little more.
No point asking if I get a kiss for that, I guess. For bringing my shoes, which you left behind. Fair enough.
He held up his hands and continued speaking as they walked on, and Liesel made a concerted effort to ignore him. She only heard the last part.
Probably wouldn't want to kiss you anyway. Not if your breath's anything like your shoes. You disgust me,
she informed him, and she hoped he couldn't see the escaped beginnings of a smile that had fallen from her mouth. On Himmel Street, Rudy captured the book. Under a lamppost, he read out the title and wondered what it was about. Dreamily, Liesel answered,
Just a murderer.
Is that all?
There's also a policeman trying to catch him.
Rudy handed it back.
Speaking of which, I think we're both slightly in for it when we get home. You especially.
Why me?
You know, your mama.
What about her? Liesel was exercising the blatant right of every person who's ever belonged to a family. It's all very well for such a person to whine and moan and criticize other family members, but they won't let anyone else do it. That's when you get your back up and show loyalty.
Is there something wrong with her?
Rudy backed away.
Sorry, Zalmensch, I didn't mean to offend you.
Even in the night, Liesel could see that Rudy was growing. His face was lengthening. The blonde shock of hair was darkening ever so slightly, and his features seemed to be changing shape. But there was one thing that would never change. It was impossible to be angry at him for long.
"Anything good to eat at your place tonight?" he asked.
"I doubted."
"Me neither. It's a shame you can't eat books.
Arthur Berg said something like that once. Remember?" They recounted the good old days for the remainder of the walk, Liesel often glancing down at the Whistler, at the grey cover and the black imprinted title. Before they went into their respective homes, Rudy stopped a moment and said,
"Goodbye, Zalmensch."
He laughed.
"Good night, book thief."
It was the first time Liesel had been branded with her title, and she couldn't hide the fact that she liked it very much. As we're both aware, she'd stolen books previously, but in late October 1941, it became official. That night, Liesel Memminger truly became the book thief.
Three Acts of Stupidity by Rudi Steiner. Rudi Steiner, pure genius. 1. He stole the biggest potato from Mamers, the local grocer. 2. Taking on Franz Deutscher on Munich Street. 3. Skipping the Hitler Youth meetings altogether. The problem with Rudi's first act was greed. It was a typically dreary afternoon in mid-November 1941. Earlier, he'd woven through the women with their coupons quite brilliantly, almost, dare I say it, with a touch of criminal genius. He nearly went completely unnoticed. Inconspicuous as he was, however, he managed to take hold of the biggest potato of the lot, the very same one that several people in the line had been watching. They all looked on as a 13-year-old fist rose up and grabbed it. A choir of heavy-set Helgas pointed him out, and Thomas Mamer came storming toward the dirty fruit.
"Meine Erdäpfel," he said. "My earth apples."
The potato was still in Rudy's hands. He couldn't hold it in just the one, and the women gathered around him like a troop of wrestlers. Some fast talking was required.
"My family," Rudi explained. A convenient stream of clear fluid began to trickle from his nose. He made a point of not wiping it away. "We're all starving. My sister needed a new coat. The last one was stolen."
Mamer was no fool. Still holding Rudi by the collar, he said,
"And you plan to dress her with a potato?"
"No, sir."
He looked diagonally into the one eye he could see of his captor. Mamer was a barrel of a man with two small bullet holes to look out of. His teeth were like a soccer crowd crammed in.
"We traded all our points for the coat 3 weeks ago, and now we have nothing to eat."
The grocer held Rudi in one hand and the potato in the other. He called out the dreaded word to his wife.
"Polizei!"
"No," Rudi begged. "Please."
He would tell Liesel later on that he was not the slightest bit afraid, but his heart was certainly bursting at that moment, I'm sure.
"Not the police. Please, not the police."
"Polizei."
Mamer remained unmoved as the boy wriggled and fought with the air. Also in the line that afternoon was a teacher, Herr Link. He was in the percentage of teachers at school who were not priests or nuns. Rudi found him and accosted him in the eyes.
"Herr Link."
This was his last chance.
"Herr Link, tell him, please, tell him how poor I am."
The grocer looked at the teacher with inquiring eyes. Herr Link stepped forward and said,
"Yes, Herr Mamer, this boy is poor. He's from Himmel Street."
The crowd of predominantly women conferred at that point, knowing that Himmel Street was not exactly the epitome of idyllic mulking living. It was well known as a relatively poor neighborhood.
"He has 8 brothers and sisters."
8.
Rudi had to hold back a smile, though he wasn't in the clear yet. At least he had the teacher lying now. He'd somehow managed to add 3 more children to the Steiner family.
"Often he comes to school without breakfast."
And the crowd of women was conferring again. It was like a coat of paint on the situation, adding a little extra potency and atmosphere.
"So that means he should be allowed to steal my potatoes?"
"The biggest one,"
one of the women ejaculated.
"Keep quiet, Frau Metzing,"
Mamer warned her, and she quickly settled down. At first, all attention was on Rudi and the scruff of his neck. It then moved back and forth, from the boy to the potato to Mamer, from best-looking to worst. And exactly what made the grocer decide in Rudy's favor would forever be unanswered. Was it the pathetic nature of the boy? The dignity of Herr Link? The annoyance of Frau Metzing? Whatever it was, Mamer dropped the potato back on the pile and dragged Rudi from his premises. He gave him a good push with his right boot and said,
"Don't come back!"
From outside, Rudi looked on as Mamer reached the counter to serve his next customer with food and sarcasm.
"I wonder which potato you're going to ask for,"
he said, keeping one eye open for the boy. For Rudi, it was yet another failure.
The second act of stupidity was equally dangerous, but for different reasons. Rudy would finish this particular altercation with a black eye, cracked ribs, and a haircut. Again, at the Hitler Youth meetings, Tommy Müller was having his problems, and Franz Deutscher was just waiting for Rudy to step in. It didn't take long. Rudy and Tommy were given another comprehensive drill session, while the others went inside to learn tactics. As they ran in the cold, they could see the warm heads and shoulders through the windows. Even when they joined the rest of the group, the drills weren't quite finished. As Rudy slumped into the corner and flicked mud from his sleeve at the window, Franz fired the Hitler Youth's favorite question at him.
"When was our Führer, Adolf Hitler, born?"
Rudy looked up. "Sorry?" The question was repeated, and the very stupid Rudy Steiner, who knew all too well that it was April the 20th, 1889, answered with the birth of Christ. He even threw in Bethlehem as an added piece of information. Franz smeared his hands together. A very bad sign. He walked over to Rudy and ordered him back outside for some more laps of the field. Rudy ran them alone, and after every lap, he was asked again the date of the Führer's birthday. He did 7 laps before he got it right. The major trouble occurred a few days after the meeting. On Munich Street, Rudy noticed Deutscher walking along the footpath with some friends and felt the need to throw a rock at him.
You might well ask just what the hell he was thinking.
The answer is probably nothing at all. He'd probably say that he was exercising his God-given right to stupidity. Either that, or the very sight of Franz Deutscher gave him the urge to destroy himself. The rock hit its mark on the spine, though not as hard as Rudy might have hoped. Franz Deutscher spun around and looked happy to find him standing there with Liesel, Tommy, and Tommy's little sister, Christina.
"Let's run,"
Liesel urged him, but Rudy didn't move.
"We're not at Hitler Youth now," he informed her.
The older boys had already arrived. Liesel remained next to her friend, as did the twitching Tommy and the delicate Christina.
"Mr. Steiner," Franz declared, before picking him up and throwing him to the pavement.
When Rudy stood up, it served only to infuriate Deutscher even more. He brought him to the ground for a second time, following him down with a knee to the ribcage. Again, Rudy stood up, and the group of older boys laughed now at their friend. This was not the best news for Rudy.
"Can't you make him feel it?"
the tallest of them said. His eyes were as blue and cold as the sky, and the words were all the incentive Franz needed. He was determined that Rudy would hit the ground and stay there. A larger crowd made its way around them as Rudy swung at Franz Deutscher's stomach, missing him completely. Simultaneously, he felt the burning sensation of a fist on his left eye socket. It arrived with sparks, and he was on the ground before he even realized. He was punched again in the same place, and he could feel the bruise turn yellow and blue and black all at once. 3 layers of exhilarating pain. The developing crowd gathered and leered to see if Rudy might get up again. He didn't. This time, he remained on the cold, wet ground, feeling it rise through his clothes and spread itself out. The sparks were still in his eyes, and he didn't notice until it was too late that Franz now stood above him with a brand new pocket knife, about to crouch down and cut him.
"No!"
Liesel protested, but the tall one held her back. In her ear, his words were deep and old.
"Don't worry," he assured her. "He won't do it. He doesn't have the guts."
He was wrong. Franz merged into a kneeling position as he leaned closer to Rudy and whispered, "When was our Führer born?" Each word was carefully created and fed into his ear. "Come on, Rudy, when was he born? You can tell me, everything's fine, don't be afraid." And Rudy, how did he reply? Did he respond prudently, or did he allow his stupidity to sink himself deeper into the mire?
He looked happily into the pale blue eyes of Franz Deutscher and whispered,
Easter Monday.
Within a few seconds, the knife was applied to his hair. It was haircut number 2 in this section of Liesel's life. The hair of a Jew was cut with rusty scissors. Her best friend was taken to with a gleaming knife. She knew nobody who actually paid for a haircut. As for Rudy, so far this year he'd swallowed mud, bathed himself in fertilizer, been half-strangled by a developing criminal, and was now receiving something at least nearing the icing on the cake. Public humiliation on Munich Street. For the most part, his fringe was sliced away freely, but with each stroke there were always a few hairs that held on for dear life and were pulled out completely. As each one was plucked, Rudy winced, his black eye throbbing in the process and his ribs flashing in pain.
April 20th, 1889,
Franz lectured him, and when he led his cohorts away, the audience dispersed, leaving only Liesel, Tommy, and Christina with their friend. Rudy lay quietly on the ground, in the rising damp. Which leaves us only with stupid act number 3, skipping the Hitler Youth meetings. He didn't stop going right away, purely to show Deutscher that he wasn't afraid of him, but after another few weeks, Rudy ceased his involvement altogether. Dressed proudly in his uniform, he exited Himmel Street and kept walking, his loyal subject, Tommy, by his side. Instead of attending the Hitler Youth, they walked out of town and along the Amper, skipping stones, heaving enormous rocks into the water, and generally getting up to no good. He made sure to get the uniform dirty enough to fool his mother, at least until the first letter arrived. That was when he heard the dreaded call from the kitchen. First, his parents threatened him. He didn't attend. They begged him to go. He refused. Eventually, it was the opportunity to join a different division that swayed Rudy in the right direction. This was fortunate, because if he didn't show his face soon, the Steiners would be fined for his non-attendance. His older brother, Kurt, inquired as to whether Rudy might join the Flieger division, which specialized in the teaching of aircraft and flying. Mostly, they built model airplanes, and there was no Franz Deutscher. Rudy accepted, and Tommy also joined. It was the one time in his life that his idiotic behavior delivered beneficial results. In his new division, whenever he was asked the famous Führer question, Rudy would smile and answer, April the 20th, 1889. And then to Tommy, he'd whisper a different date, like Beethoven's birthday, or Mozart's, or Strauss's. They'd been learning about composers in school, where despite his obvious stupidity, Rudy excelled. The Floating Book, Part 2. At the beginning of December, victory finally came to Rudy Steiner, though not in a typical fashion. It was a cold day, but very still. It had come close to snowing. After school, Rudy and Liesel stopped in at Alex Steiner's shop, and as they walked home, they saw Rudy's old friend Franz Deutscher coming around the corner. Liesel, as was her habit these days, was carrying the whistler. She liked to feel it in her hand, either the smooth spine or the rough edges of paper. It was she who saw him first.
Look!
She pointed. Deutscher was loping toward them with another Hitler Youth leader. Rudy shrank into himself. He felt at his mending eye.
Not this time.
He searched the streets.
If we go past the church, we can follow the river and cut back that way.
With no further words, Liesel followed him, and they successfully avoided Rudy's tormentor, straight into the path of another. At first, they thought nothing of it. The group crossing the bridge and smoking cigarettes could have been anybody, and it was too late to turn around when the two parties recognized each other.
Oh, no, they've seen us.
Victor Chemmel smiled. He spoke very amiably. This could only mean that he was at his most dangerous.
Well, well, if it isn't Rudi Steiner and his little whore.
Very smoothly, he met them and snatched the whistler from Liesel's grip.
What are we reading?
This is between us.
Rudi tried to reason with him.
It has nothing to do with her. Come on, give it back.
The whistler?
He addressed Liesel now.
Any good?
She cleared her throat.
Not bad.
Unfortunately, she gave herself away. In the eyes, they were agitated. She knew the exact moment when Victor Chemmel established that the book was a prize possession.
I'll tell you what, he said. For 50 marks, you can have it back.
50 marks?
That was Andy Schmeichel. Come on, Victor, you could buy 1,000 books for that.
Did I ask you to speak?
Andy kept quiet. His mouth seemed to swing shut. Liesel tried a poker face.
You can keep it, then. I've already read it.
What happens at the end?
Damn it. She hadn't gotten that far yet. She hesitated, and Victor Chemmel deciphered it instantly.
Rudi rushed at him now.
Come on, Victor. Don't do this to her. It's me you're after. I'll do anything you want.
The older boy only swatted him away, the book held aloft. And he corrected him.
No, he said. I'll do anything I want.
And he proceeded to the river. Everyone followed at catch-up speed, half walk, half run. Some protested, some urged him on. It was so quick and relaxed. There was a question and a mocking, friendly voice.
Tell me, Victor said. Who was the last Olympic discus champion in Berlin?
He turned to face them. He warmed up his arm.
Who was it? God damn it, it's on the tip of my tongue. It was that American, wasn't it? Carpenter or something.
Please!
Rudi. The water toppled. Victor Chemmel did the spin. The book was released gloriously from his hand. It opened and flapped, the pages rattling as it covered ground in the air. More abruptly than expected, it stopped and appeared to be sucked toward the water. It clapped when it hit the surface and began to float downstream. Victor shook his head.
Not enough height, a poor throw.
He smiled again, but still good enough to win, huh? Liesel and Rudi didn't stick around to hear the laughter. Rudi, in particular, had taken off down the riverbank, attempting to locate the book.
Can you see it?
Liesel called out. Rudi ran. He continued down the water's edge, showing her the book's location.
Over there!
He stopped and pointed and ran farther down to overtake it. Soon he peeled off his coat and jumped in, wading to the middle of the river. Liesel, slowing to a walk, could see the ache of each step. The painful cold. When she was close enough, she saw it move past him, but he soon caught up. His hand reached in and collared what was now a soggy block of cardboard and paper.
The Whistler!
The boy called out. It was the only book floating down the Amper River that day, but he still felt the need to announce it. Another note of interest is that Rudi did not attempt to leave the devastatingly cold water as soon as he held the book in his hand. For a good minute or so, he stayed. He never did explain it to Liesel, but I think she knew very well that the reasons were twofold. The Frozen Motives of Rudi Steiner. 1. After months of failure, this moment was his only chance to revel in some victory. 2. Such a position of selflessness was a good place to ask Liesel for the usual favor. How could she possibly turn him down?
How about a kiss, Sarmensch?
He stood waist-deep in the water for a few moments longer before climbing out and handing her the book. His pants clung to him, and he did not stop walking. In truth, I think he was afraid. Rudi Steiner was scared of the book thief's kiss. He must have longed for it so much. He must have loved her so incredibly hard. So hard that he would never ask for her lips again and would go to his grave without them.
Part 6. The Dream Carrier. Featuring Death's Diary, The Snowman, 13 Presents, The Next Book, The Nightmare of a Jewish Corpse, A Newspaper Sky, A Visitor, A Schmunzler, and A Final Kiss on Poisoned Cheeks. Death's Diary, 1942. It was a year for the ages, like 79, like 1346, to name just a few. Forget the scythe, goddammit, I needed a broom or a mop. And I needed a vacation. A small piece of truth. I do not carry a sickle or scythe. I only wear a hooded black robe when it's cold. And I don't have those skull-like facial features you seem to enjoy pinning on me from a distance. You want to know what I truly look like? I'll help you out. Find yourself a mirror while I continue. I actually feel quite self-indulgent at the moment, telling you all about me, 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 my travels, what I saw in 42. On the other hand, you're a human. You should understand self-obsession. The point is, there's a reason for me explaining what I saw in that time. Much of it would have repercussions for Liesel Memminger. It brought the war closer to Himmel Street, and it dragged me along for the ride. There were certainly some rounds to be made that year, from Poland to Russia to Africa and back again. You might argue that I make the rounds no matter what year it is, but sometimes the human race likes to crank things up a little. They increase the production of bodies and their escaping souls. A few bombs usually do the trick. Or some gas chambers. Or the chit-chat of faraway guns. If none of that finishes proceedings, it at least strips people of their living arrangements. And I witness the homeless everywhere. They often come after me as I wander through the streets of molested cities. They beg me to take them with me. Not realizing I'm too busy as it is. Your time will come, I convince them, and I try not to look back. At times, I wish I could say something like, don't you see I've already got enough on my plate? But I never do. I complain internally as I go about my work, and some years, the souls and bodies don't add up. They multiply. An abridged roll call for 1942. 1. The Desperate Jews. Their spirits in my lap as we sat on the roof next to the steaming chimneys. 2. The Russian soldiers, taking only small amounts of ammunition, relying on the fallen for the rest of it. 3. The soaked bodies of a French coast, beached on the shingle and sand. I could go on, but I've decided for now that 3 examples will suffice. 3 examples, if nothing else, will give you the ashen taste in your mouth that defined my existence during that year. So many humans, so many colors. They keep triggering inside me. They harass my memory. I see them tall in their heaps, all mounted on top of each other. There is air like plastic, a horizon like setting glue. There are skies manufactured by people, punctured and leaking. And there are soft, coal-colored clouds, beating like black hearts. And then there is death, making his way through all of it. On the surface, unflappable, unwavering. Below, unnerved, untied, and undone. In all honesty, and I know I'm complaining excessively now, I was still getting over Stalin in Russia. The so-called Second Revolution, the murder of his own people. Then came Hitler. They say that war is death's best friend. But I must offer you a different point of view on that one. To me, war is like the new boss who expects the impossible. He stands over your shoulder repeating one thing incessantly. Get it done. Get it done. So you work harder. You get the job done. The boss, however, does not thank you. He asks for more. Often,
I try to remember the strewn pieces of beauty I saw in that time as well. I plow through my library of stories. In fact, I reach for one now. I believe you know half of it already, and if you come with me, I'll show you the rest. I'll show you the second half of A Book Thief. Unknowingly, she awaits a great many things that I alluded to just a minute ago, but she also waits for you. She's carrying some snow down to a basement, of all places. Handfuls of frosty water can make almost anyone smile, but it cannot make them forget. Here she comes. The Snowman. For Liesl Memminger, the early stages of 1942 could be summed up like this. She became 13 years of age. Her chest was still flat. She had not yet bled. The young man from her basement was now in her bed. Q&A. How did Max Vandenberg end up in Liesl's bed? He fell. Opinions varied, but Rosa Huberman claimed that the seeds were sown at Christmas the previous year. December the 24th had been hungry and cold, but there was a major bonus, no lengthy visitations. Hans Jr. was simultaneously shooting at Russians and maintaining his strike on family interaction. Trudy could only stop by on the weekend before Christmas for a few hours. She was going away with her family of employment, a holiday for a very different class of Germany. On Christmas Eve, Liesl brought down a double handful of snow as a present for Max.
"Close your eyes," she'd said. "Hold out your hands."
As soon as the snow was transferred, Max shivered and laughed, but he still didn't open his eyes. He only gave the snow a quick taste, allowing it to sink into his lips. "Is this today's weather report?" Liesl stood next to him. Gently, she touched his arm. He raised it again to his mouth. "Thanks, Liesl." It was the beginning of the greatest Christmas ever. Little food, no presents, but there was a snowman in their basement. After delivering the first handfuls of snow, Liesl checked that no one else was outside, then proceeded to take as many buckets and pots out as she could. She filled them with the mounds of snow and ice that blanketed the small strip of world that was Himmel Street. Once they were full, she brought them in and carried them down to the basement. All things being fair, she first threw a snowball at Max and collected a reply in the stomach. Max even threw one at Hans Huberman as he made his way down the basement steps.
"Arschloch!" Papa yelped.
"Liesl, give me some of that snow, a whole bucket!"
For a few minutes, they all forgot. There was no more yelling or calling out, but they could not contain the small snatches of laughter. They were only humans playing in the snow in a house. Papa looked at the snow-filled pots.
"What do we do with the rest of it?"
"A snowman," Liesl replied. "We have to make a snowman."
Papa called out to Rosa. The usual distant voice was hurled back.
"What is it now, Saukerl? Come down here, will you?"
When his wife appeared, Hans Huberman risked his life by throwing a most excellent snowball at her. Just missing, it disintegrated when it hit the wall, and Mama had an excuse to swear for a long time without taking a breath. Once she recovered, she came down and helped them. She even brought the buttons for the eyes and nose, and some string for a snowman smile. Even a scarf and hat were provided for what was really only a 2-foot man of snow.
"A midget," Max had said. "What do we do when it melts?"
Liesl asked. Rosa had the answer.
"You mop it up, Saumensch, in a hurry."
Papa disagreed.
"It won't melt."
He rubbed his hands and blew into them.
"It's freezing down here."
Melt it did, though. But somewhere in each of them, that snowman was still upright. It must have been the last thing they saw that Christmas Eve when they finally fell asleep. There was an accordion in their ears, a snowman in their eyes, and for Liesl, there was the thought of Max's last words before she left him by the fire.
Christmas greetings from Max Vandenberg.
Often, I wish this would all be over, Liesl. But then somehow you do something, like walk down the basement steps with a snowman in your hands. Unfortunately, that night signaled a severe downslide in Max's health. The early signs were innocent enough and typical. Constant coldness, swimming hands, increased visions of boxing with the Führer. It was only when he couldn't warm up after his push-ups and sit-ups that it truly began to worry him. As close to the fire as he sat, he could not raise himself to any degree of approximate health. Day by day, his weight began to stumble off him. His exercise regimen faltered and fell apart, with his cheek against the surly basement floor. All through January, he managed to hold himself together, but by early February, Max was in worrisome shape. He would struggle to wake up next to the fire, sleeping well into the morning instead, his mouth distorted and his cheekbones starting to swell. When asked, he said he was fine. In mid-February, a few days before Liesl was 13, he came to the fireplace on the verge of collapse. He nearly fell into the fire. "Hans," he whispered, and his face seemed to cramp. His legs gave way, and his head hit the accordion case. At once, a wooden spoon fell into some soup, and Rosa Huberman was at his side. She held Max's head and barked across the room at Liesl. "Don't just stand there. Get the extra blankets. Take them to your bed. And you," Papa was next, "help me pick him up and carry him to Liesl's room. Schnell!" Papa's face was stretched with concern. His grey eyes clanged, and he picked him up on his own. Max was light as a child. "Can't we put him here, in our bed?" Rosa had already considered that. "No, we have to keep these curtains open in the day, or else it looks suspicious."
"Good point."
Hans carried him out. Blankets in hand, Liesl watched. Limp feet and hanging hair in the hallway. One shoe had fallen off him.
"Move!"
Mama marched in behind them, in her waddlesome way. Once Max was in the bed, blankets were heaped on top and fastened around his body.
"Mama?"
Liesl couldn't bring herself to say anything else.
"What?"
The bun of Rosa Huberman's hair was wound tight enough to frighten from behind. It seemed to tighten further when she repeated the question.
"What, Liesl?"
She stepped closer, afraid of the answer.
"Is he alive?"
The bun nodded. Rosa turned then and said something with great assurance.
"Now listen to me, Liesl. I didn't take this man into my house to watch him die. Understand?"
Liesl nodded.
"Now go."
In the hall, Papa hugged her. She desperately needed it. Later on, she heard Hans and Rosa speaking in the night. Rosa made her sleep in their room, and she lay next to their bed, on the floor, on the mattress they'd dragged up from the basement. There was concern as to whether it was infected, but they came to the conclusion that such thoughts were unfounded. This was no virus Max was suffering from, so they carried it up and replaced the sheet. Imagining the girl to be asleep, Mama voiced her opinion.
"Damn snowman," she whispered. "I bet it started with the snowman, fooling around with ice and snow in the cold down there."
Papa was more philosophical. "Rosa, it started with Adolf."
He lifted himself.
"We should check on him."
In the course of the night, Max was visited 7 times. Max Vandenberg's visitor score sheet. Hans Huberman, 2. Rosa Huberman, 2. Liesl Memminger, 3. In the morning, Liesl brought him his sketchbook from the basement and placed it on the bedside table. She felt awful for having looked at it the previous year, and this time she kept it firmly closed, out of respect. When Papa came in, she did not turn to face him, but talked across Max Vandenberg, at the wall.
"Why did I have to bring all that snow down?"
she asked.
It started all of this, didn't it, Papa?
She clenched her hands as if to pray.
Why did I have to build that snowman?